WNYC receives support from McGraw-Hill Education, offering the Access Medicine Suite, a collection of clinical solutions in internal medicine, cardiology, surgery, pediatrics, and more for medical schools and hospitals. Learn more at mhmedical.com.
By the year 2080, cities will be home to 80% of the world's population, and they'll be increasingly plagued by problems such as climate change, overcrowding, a lack of affordable housing, and income inequality. In The Well-Tempered City, what modern science, ancient civilizations, and human nature teach us about the future of urban life, urban planner and real estate developer Jonathan F.P. Rose presents a five-pronged model for how to design and reshape our cities with the goal of creating opportunities and building sustainable communities. Mr. Rose is the founder of Jonathan Rose Companies, a policy, development, and urban planning firm that works with cities to plan and build affordable mixed-income housing and cultural health and education centers. His book is published by Harper Wave. I'm very pleased it has brought him to our show today. Hello.
Good morning. Thank you to be here. Nice
and
to be here.
I'm assuming that the title, Well-Tempered City, was inspired by Bach?
It was inspired by Bach's Well-Tempered Clavier.
What do you mean by the phrase well-tempered city?
So first, let's go back to Bach. So what happened is around the turn of the around 1700, I'm going to go way back, 2500 BC.
Let's go back even before.
Right. So I can do that too. But 2500 BC, Pythagoras observed that the ratio between the notes on the scale of music were exactly the same proportion as the ratio between the planets. And he said this was a golden proportion and that anything that was perfect in the universe fit within this ratio. He was partially correct. That ratio actually occurs in much in nature, but it also doesn't occur in much in nature. And ever since then, in Western music, every scale was tuned exactly to this ratio. And it meant that the scales themselves were beautiful and perfect, but you couldn't go from scale to scale because they didn't close. They actually clashed with each other. So music had to be mono-key. Around the end of the 1600s, a system comes from China and called temperament, which is a way of tuning slightly off perfection, but in between. So all of a sudden you could go from key to key to key. I call that a new operating system actually for music, and at the same time a new technology, the clavier, which is the forerunner of the piano, was invented. And Bach took these two and said all of a sudden it opens up every key on the keyboard and he could create a magnificent tapestry of music. He could extend his harmonies. And his mission, because he was quite religious, was to map the elegance and harmony of the universe and bring that to life on earth through music. And the Well-Tempered Clavier, written in two books, does this. When I look at the issue of cities and urbanization, you describe many of the problems we're facing today. The question I ask is, how do we create greater harmony action in our cities too? And what the Well-Tempered Clavier points to is this idea of integration, that we actually need to find new systems that allow us to integrate what are often very siloed issues to come to solutions.
What are the biggest threats currently facing the world's cities?
So first of all, the world's population is going to grow to about 10 billion people by 2050.
Well, we keep on just building taller, don't we?
Well, we can build taller, but what this means is, number one, that brings transportation systems, our infrastructure have to be updated to deal with it. But also, the world's population is becoming better off, which is good, but it means we are consuming far more things, and that is bad for the environment, and the Earth, frankly, can't sustain that. We're seeing a growing gap between rich and poor, and we know how income inequality does not help. And interestingly, when you look throughout history and you see this confluence of the climate changing, the population growing and resources depleting and income inequality, in almost every case, you get collapse.
My guest is Jonathan F.P. Rose. His book, The Well-Tempered City, What Modern Science, Ancient Civilizations, and Human Nature Teach Us About the Future of Urban Life. It is published by Harper Wave. This is WMIC, WMIC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. You write, most of our cities have lost their original higher purpose. What was the higher purpose?
Well, it's really interesting when you look at the very formation of cities, both in every place that cities were born, and they're born in many separate places around the world, but right now let's take China and the Middle East.
The first ones were from the Middle East, weren't they?
The very first ones were in the Middle East, and they were always formed around a temple. There was always a temple first. In fact, temples were built before even huts were built. And the purpose of the temples were twofold. They were to align humans in nature, and they also meted out justice, and they actually meted out the fair distribution of goods. One of the reasons why we have early writing and accounting systems, those were actually held by the priests were the ones who were educated, and they held the great storehouses, the warehouses. People would put their grain in and then know they would be fairly stored, accounted for, and distributed back out.
So does that apply not just to the Middle East, Iraq, interestingly, Mesopotamia, but also to Africa, to Asia, to Mesoamerica, to South America? Everyone started as religious centers?
Actually, interestingly, we know the least about the growth of cities in Africa. It was much slower. But absolutely in Asia, Middle East, Asia, South America, yes. All those early Mayan cities, etc., they all started around a temple, and they started around... But there are many other things that led to the birth of cities, too.
They are a key moment in the evolution of civilization.
Right. And actually, the book traces from the beginning of language through to the beginning of cities. And what we see, there's a whole pattern of things. You have to have commerce. You have to have... The cities have to begin to differentiate themselves. You can't have commerce. If everybody makes the same thing, there's nothing to trade. So you get differentiation. You begin to get connectivity that happens between cities. You begin to build cities as networks. The archaeologists call it an interaction sphere.
And rivals.
And you have rivals, but actually war did not occur until about 500 years after the birth of cities. Initially, cities were much more collaborators.
Now, you say that the proto-city of Eridu in the Ubaid prehistoric Mesopotamia, now Iraq, was the first?
Yes.
And then when did the cities begin to emerge around the world? How far back are we going?
So the first cities in Mesopotamia emerged around 38 to 3200 BC. There were, the first known town actually is Jericho, which is about 8,000 BC, and then they slowly get more and more towns.
Do we know why they were developing?
Yeah, we knew they were developing because they were places of opportunity, and that has been really one of the whole notes of cities for a long time. But they were also developing because, as I was describing, they were interconnecting. And when you connect cities, when you connect towns, when you connect any node on a system, the system itself begins to thrive.
What are the major differences between Eastern and Western systems of thought in terms of planning cities?
So it's interesting. If you remember the Greeks, let's go back to the Greeks, and one of the great contributions to scientific thinking of the Greeks was the idea of the atom. The atom is the idea that there is an irreducible individual part. And we Westerners tend to think of ourselves. We're very self-centered. We think of ourselves as we're self-actualizing, we're self-entrepreneurs, etc. The Eastern system was all about the whole. It was not about the part. It's a completely different way of thinking. And the role of a leader in Chinese civilization and Eastern civilizations was to maintain the harmony between heaven and earth. And people felt themselves to entirely be part of a system. The Chinese had this fascinating city planning methodology, which was a map of the universe called the nine square system. So their fields were all divided into nine squares, and eight of the squares were all, each an individual farmer would have to farm for themselves, and they all collectively squared the farm, the center square, the ninth square, and that was a tax in effect, and that went to the regional town. Where it was stored, the town was laid out in nine squares, and in the center of the square, the ninth square, was the warehouse and the administration. And that went to the larger regional city, and ultimately that all went to the capital, and at the capital, in the very heart of the capital, is where the emperor lived. And his job was to maintain the balance of heaven and earth, and it was distributed through that entire nine-square, multi-level kind of fractal map that covered the entire country. It's an amazing system.
I visited some of the early cities of North America, right, in Teotihuacan, for example, right, Monte Alban, but also places like Chaco Canyon, right, in Arizona, and they all were civic centers as much as they were religious centers.
Exactly. So what you begin to see is there's this amazing confluence between commerce and spirituality. And there are very few places where they're entirely separate And I think the forces that bring people together to both seek higher purposes also bring them together to trade.
Well, how do these systems of thought continue to influence how we look at cities today?
So until very recently, the Eastern cities grew in a very different pattern than the Western cities did as imperialism took over, although the kind of European model of city has really dominated city planning throughout the world.
Let me stop you for a second.
Yeah.
When you say European models, right, don't the models change European country by European country? So when the Dutch came here, were they bringing a different concept than the English, than the Spanish, than the French?
You are right. There are commonalities between cultures, and there are absolute differences, and those differences get really subtle, and that's what leads to the diversity of places. So one of the things we know is actually the Dutch that brought a particular kind of not only entrepreneurialism, but a kind of democracy to America that then seeded ultimately our democratic system.
And created New York City as
right.
a different kind of city than the other early cities,
exactly,
in at least on the eastern seaboard.
Right. So we think of ourselves as coming from English origins, but really the roots of our democracy come from Dutch origins.
You say that for as long as we've had cities, we've had suburbs. Have suburbs really existed for thousands of years?
They have been because for all the reasons that we have suburbs today, cities were great magnets of power, and their magnets of economic opportunity, but also people wanted to, you know, the wealthy always had villas. You can see this actually if you go to Rome and you see, for example, Heraclium, which was destroyed when Vesuvius blew up, was kind of a suburb of Pompeii. So even if you look at the master plan of Pompeii, there's a dense city, and then it kind of gets to the villas on the outskirts.
I've seen this actually near Monte Alban in Oaxaca, mm-hmm, where there are these houses for rich people, mm-hmm, that are set across the valley from Monte Alban, and it's very much like modern life. There's a big house, and then there's a little passageway, and then there's a small house where the servants lived.
Right. One of the interesting things actually is we can judge the level of income inequality in cities by the variation in the sizes of houses.
Are modern American suburbs distinctive in any way?
They are distinctive. So interestingly, in the late 1800s, about 1880, somewhere around there, we invented the streetcar system or the trolley system. And it all of a sudden allowed cities to sprawl out. But they sprawled out in mass transit-oriented ways, and they clusters around the trolley stops. It was actually a very good form of development. And there's some classic towns like Shaker Heights, Ohio, Roland Park in Baltimore that were formed on this system. When the automobile came, then we had more undifferentiated sprawl. It's still different pattern in New England than it is, for example, in the South or in the West. But our sprawl became more unified.
And it's different because the sprawl developed at different times, or is just the nature of the local communities?
So some of it's different times. Some of it is the physical shape. So, for example, in a place like Phoenix, which is very flat, it's easy to sprawl in all directions. In places like more mountainous communities or New England, we are more shaped by our geography.
But in a city like Phoenix, usually there is a major road that goes through, and people exit off of that
right.
road into the various communities.
Many of the Western cities are bisected. Many of the Western cities' sprawl really started when the interstate highway system took off after World War II, and the major cities are actually a crossroad between the Eastern Highway the East-West Highway and the North-South Highway. So you see sprawl in multiple directions.
My guest is Jonathan Rose, who's written a book called The Well-Tempered City, What Modern Science, Ancient Civilizations, and Human Nature Teach Us About the Future of Urban Life. It is published by Harperwave, and we will continue our conversation after this. We're back with Jonathan F.P. Rose. His book, The Well-Tempered City, What Modern Science, Ancient Civilizations, and Human Nature Teach Us About the Future of Urban Life. It's published by Harper Wave. When did the United States develop its first affordable housing policy?
So I actually say that our first affordable housing policy was our Homestead Act. because it was an act that said if you can get it together and get to some part of America and stake out 40 acres or 160 acres there, and you work them, live there for 5 years, build a house, they're yours. And a lot of American citizens and new immigrants took advantage of that and spread across the West.
It was also open to women and free slaves.
Yes.
Which was probably an enlightened policy at the time.
It was. But also the government really wanted to be settled. I believe, though, that it was not open to slave owners, and so actually it was a discriminatory policy.
Well, I prefer to give it to free slaves than to slave owners. But why?
This is after the Civil War. So former slave owners were held back from this opportunity.
Why did the United States housing policy become politicized in the 1930s?
So really interesting thing happened. In the 1930s, all around the world, people began to recognize that the urbanization that had been happening, that it had both positive and negative effects, and the industrialization that was happening had really created some terrible slums for workers. And we knew this back in New York City in the 1890s with Jacob Riis, who took these really important photographs. So as people began to finally wrestle with the need for an affordable housing policy, Washington actually, and the Depression was starting, started to create some housing programs. The Home Builders Association, the National Mortgage Brokers Association, and the National Realtors Association, which were busy selling single-family houses in the suburbs, didn't want to see the federal government do anything that would remove any of their market, that would reduce any of their market of home buyers. And so they lobbied aggressively for American housing policy to only provide public housing to the poor. In the rest of the world, so in Europe, the what we'd call social housing policy was to create mixed income communities, which turn out to be much, much healthier. It turns out that that consistent lobbying, which went on for decades, that public housing could not serve the middle class, ended up creating stronger ghettos.
Is that breaking down at all today with gentrification?
So there are two separate issues. So number one is breaking down because we much better recognize the value of mixed income communities.
Although we still have the NIMBY attitude.
We do. But so in the 1990s, a wonderful program called the HOPE 6 program, which is unfortunately unfunded now, but started in the actually conceived of under the first Bush administration by Jack Kemp, and then really built up under the Clinton administration, started taking down monoculture public housing and replacing it with mixed income housing. We see programs that are currently on hold in New York City, but like the 80-20 program, in which we were building market rate housing and affordable housing together. And these have been very good strategies actually for diversifying our population, but we need to bring them to a much larger scale to really deal with the issues of affordable housing New York City and other cities face.
I just saw a documentary film about the Chelsea area where the High Line has changed the composition of the population there, but there are housing projects as well. And there's a really strong sense of separation between the two. The kids who come to the fancy school, the school that costs quite a bit of money, that's situated directly across from the projects, they don't mingle with the other kids. And one of the richer black kids said, this is not a matter of, when I meet black kids from the projects, they don't see me as a brother. They see me as some rich kid.
So I believe that one of the responsibilities of leadership and one of the things we need to aim for in our communities is to weave together the fabric of community. It takes many things to do that. Interestingly, the High Line and the people who lead the High Line are actually very dedicated to this and are doing programs with the public housing nearby. Obviously, we can always use more, but the High Line interest is making a strong effort in this area.
In an interview with the Washington Post, you said, we use the power of gentrification to help create more affordable housing rather than take it away.
So let me explain that. In addition to being a planner and a writer, I'm a real estate developer, and we did an amazing project that's under construction now called Portner Flats in Washington at 14th and U, which is one of the hottest, it was an inner city neighborhood that now has become one of the hottest neighborhoods in Washington, rapidly gentrifying, lots of young millennials living in market rate buildings there. We found our company found a 48-unit Section 8 old building, series of buildings, low-income residents. We worked with the residents, And we propose to actually tear that down, move them off-site temporarily, and rebuild it, doubling the affordability to 96 units. In exchange, it was a very low-density site. The city rezoned the site so we could build 250 market-rate units. We then used some of the money generated by the market-rate units to subsidize the doubling of the affordable housing. So it took the power of the market to actually double affordability, and it turns out the residents are really happy, the neighbors love it. It's a real model.
But we do see, with some of the gentrification here in New York City, resentment from the longtime residents of these newcomers, especially since it drives up rents.
And this is a serious problem. It is absolutely. So gentrification brings many good things to neighborhoods, and it not only drives up rents, but, for example, it takes affordable restaurants and makes them into much more expensive, unaffordable restaurants. So I actually believe one of the things we need to do, Mayor de Blasio, I really salute him for trying to build and preserve 200,000 units of affordable housing in the city. That's very important. Probably the next thing we need to do is an affordable shopkeeper program. And the real solution to that goes back to the 1960s. In the 60s and early 70s, when SoHo was going through its transition from becoming a manufacturing district to an arts district, many artists created co-ops and bought their homes. And today they may be a struggling artist or teaching, but they're living in a place with millions of dollars of equity value. We need to create a program to allow shopkeepers and small business owners in neighborhoods that are in the pathway of future gentrification to own their buildings so that when gentrification happens, they have equity in it.
We're also seeing quite a few buildings that have two entrances, two lobbies, a fancy lobby for the wealthier people, and then the poor door lobby for the people who are at market rate rents, because that's part of the tax structure of building new housing in the city.
We're actually not saying that. That's been way magnified. There are some rich door, poor door buildings, but most of the affordable most of the market rate and even luxury rental housing that is being built in New York City and that has been built in New York City, all the residents go through the same door. And what's really interesting is you cannot tell the difference when you look at somebody who's earning 50% of the area median income or 10 times the area median income. They're all human beings. They all look and behave the same.
I'm talking with Jonathan F.P. Rose, his book, The Well-Tempered City. Rose of the Planetarium Rose family?
That was my father, yes.
You write that biocomplexity provides the best model for city planning and development systems to be able to adapt to the road ahead. How does that
work? Okay, so let's go back and first understand what biocomplexity is. So think very simply in nature. Human beings breathe in oxygen. We breathe out carbon dioxide. Trees breathe out oxygen and in carbon dioxide. How did all that happen? You may have heard that humans and frogs share 50% of the same DNA. We and monkeys share 96% of the same DNA. How does all this happen? Humans and wheat, by the way, share 18% of the same DNA. It turns out that this, what's called the metagenome of life on Earth, this vast pool of DNA, is what interconnects us all and has us all co-evolve in ways that work together. What we need to do is actually to have the same pool of solutions in our cities. And what we have seen is often when you have silos, so when you have the housing department not talking to the health department, not talking to the education department, not connecting with parks and open space or transportation, you get fragmentation. The power of nature is its integration, and that's what we need in our city planning and operating.
You say that an important quality of the well-tempered city is circularity.
All right.
Explain that.
So 98% of the things that go into cities today leave as waste 6 months later. We have linear systems. And I'll talk about one of the most uncomfortable ones, which is think about our sewer system. You know, fresh water comes from upstate, it goes through, it flushes our toilet, and it comes out as waste. A very interesting, some cities are dealing with droughts around the world, particularly in the Southwest, And what we've learned is you can actually clean up that wastewater and recycle it back into drinking water. And it is what helping them become much more resilient in terms of climate change-induced droughts.
Do some cities do it better than others?
They do. The best, actually, and it was the first, it's Namibia. That's the Windhoek, the capital of Namibia, which is in southern Africa. And 40 years ago, they started cleaning up their wastewater. There's not been a single accident since. The engineer who designed it said, we need to think about water and judge it for its quality and not for its history. In the Washington metro region, the wastewater system is now, Washington, D.C., is actually taking out of the wastewater nitrogen and phosphorus, which are actually very damaging to local ecologies, for $100 a ton and selling them to fertilizer manufacturers for $400 a ton. They're taking the methane that is coming off these systems and burning it and turning it into energy that not only powers the waste treatment plant, but powers neighborhoods beyond it.
Don't we have waste treatment plants in New York City?
We do. They're not up to this state of the art. By the way, the future is, think about electric eels. There's now a biodigester. It's like a little biological electric eel that actually can create electricity directly from waste. That's still in experimental stage. But so the more we can think about our waste systems as circular systems, I'll give you another example. San Francisco is the most recycling city in the world, recycles 80% of its waste. It separates all of its organic waste and recycles it and turns it back into compost to feed the city.
Last January, New York Times architecture critic Michael Kimmelman made reference to your Jonathan Rose companies in his column about affordable housing in New York City. What is the Dream Charter School in Harlem?
So we worked with the NYCHA, the Housing Authority, took a piece of land in Washington Houses on 104th and 2nd Avenue, and helped an amazing organization, the Harlem RBI, which is a not-for-profit that has worked for a long time in the East Harlem community with kids, started with a ball field. Actually, that's where the RBI comes in, then after-school programs. And they envisioned an incredible charter school called the Dream Charter School. They were looking for a site for it. NYCHA said, and we were working with them on that. That's part of the work our company does. And NYCHA said, great, you can have the charter school, but we also want to see affordable housing. And so we built a project that has a beautiful renovated city park in front of it, has this fantastic charter school and affordable housing above. It's all green, it's all healthy, all walkable. There's a farmer's market on 104th Street just a half a block away. It's become a really great place to live.
Well, you, Kimmelman wrote that New York City once set the standard for subsidized housing. The city started out building and maintaining tens of thousands of apartments for working families, and now that's not happening anymore.
Well, New York City still manages, I think, over 200,000 public housing units.
But they're called the projects, and many of them are rather depressed state.
They are in depressed state, and actually they're in great need of rehabilitation. And one of the issues that NYCHA is now facing is where does it find the funds to be able to rehabilitate them? And the what we call the East Center, East Harlem Center for Living and Learning, this combination of school and affordable housing, is one of the answers.
Jonathan F.P. Rose will be joining Randy Cohen for a live taping of WAMC's Person, Place, Thing, Thursday, October 13th at 5:30. Sorry, I'm having problems reading this. At Columbia University. For ticket information, go to our show page at wmyc.org/lowpaid. And then on November 2nd, he will be speaking with Richard Florida at the New York Public Library's Stephen Schwarzman Building on 42nd Street. That's at 6:30. His book is called The Well-Tempered City: What Modern Science, Ancient Civilizations, and Human Nature Teach Us About the Future of Urban Life. It is published by Harper Wave, and it has been my great pleasure to have him as a guest today on our show. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you so much for having me.